Well, welcome to the pre-council meeting of the Columbia City Council. Obviously, we've made some changes tonight, and we are meeting in this council chamber. We are also introducing for the rest of our meeting this evening social distancing as evidenced by every other row removed and every other seat so as to reduce the capacity of this room. We'll have the narthex doors open, and I would encourage everybody to keep their conversations to a minimum. When we begin the 7 o'clock meeting, we'll also have the side 1A, 1B open for potential overflow. I'm going to contract the work session or the pre-council meeting so that we receive our two updates on fire and pension, but also the Cullimore cottages, and maybe staff can keep that to 10 minutes or less for each. And then I'd like to ask Stephanie Browning to come up and give us an update on the steps that she has taken, not only since January, but most recently since our community briefing on February 27th, to bring council up to speed on where we are with respect to preparedness, but then also to introduce in the regular meeting at 7, some proactive measures that I think will be council's first and last opportunity to examine and have that conversation in a public meeting. This pre-council meeting is being live streamed on the city's website so that the public also has the benefit of the information we're hearing. And I will give you some more introductory comments when we get to that part of the agenda, both in the pre-council and in the regular session. Any questions as far as this part of the agenda? What I'd like to do with respect to our pre-council is go through our two staff reports. We need to take, and as soon as we finish, but no later than 3 to 5 minutes before 7 o'clock, we need to do a hard break, and then we'll come back and reconvene in public session for our regularly scheduled council meeting, and I'll make a comment about a resolution supporting the declaration of a state of emergency. We'll do that as a special item so that we can kind of have some continuity of our discussion, using this time as a look back retrospective of the last 2 months and moving forward at the 7 o'clock meeting. Is that comfortable? Mr. Glasscock?
Yes, sir.
You want to give us a fire pension update?
We can. Our first order of business on the pre-council is police and fire pension update, and I'll invite Matthew Liu up to introduce our guest.
Come on up for the instances of time. We're also introducing some hygiene etiquette as well. We'll have a staff person from the communications department wiping down the podium and microphones after each speaker as well. Thank you, Mr. Liu.
Mayor, members of the City Council, we have Mark Shigowski here from UBS to tell us a little bit about the fire and police pension.
Thank you.
Mayor, thank you, Council. Thanks for having us here. I understand we have 10 minutes, which is, make sure it's 10 minutes.
Thank you.
A little bit of background. I apologize to the council because normally when we come in for pension meetings or any meetings, we have two members here, two different generations. I'm the older person. There's always a younger partner with me. It's a different viewpoint. And I just want to give a quick introduction. So it should be up on the screen, which is why this gentleman's here helping me.
He helps all of us.
Oh, is it okay? Good. Anybody has any questions and I go through it, please. Let's make it collegial, okay? I'm the founding partner within UBS of a group called Princeton Institutional Investment Consulting. There's 7 people between New York and Princeton, New Jersey that operate it. I'm gonna just introduce myself. I'm not new to the city of Columbia. I've graduated from the university with a master's degree in public administration. I attended school on a presidential fellowship. I was also the graduate coach or assistant coach of the cross country and track teams, and I ran also while I was here. I worked for the city as an intern for 3 of the years that I was here. I was given the task of helping to get the first certificate of conformance, if you're familiar with that, which is the highest award the city can get for their annual reports. I was in charge of doing the statistical package that's still on the back of that book. After that, I was retained and hired to be a director of the Office of State Courts Administrator in Jeff City. Any of you are old enough, Jane Hess I worked with and Ron Larkin. Okay, Jane Hess was another director. Jim Parkinson was the head of the that group. And then after that, I moved back because my family's from the Northeast, but I maintained my business connections here, have some investments in town as a limited partner, not general, so just a passive investor. If you look at what I sent over in terms of accolades, I'm a member of the GFOA, which is a Government Finance Officers Association. I lecture around the country to various GFOAs on best practices. We have a deep book within UBS. My group and another group are the only ones that are allowed to consult to municipalities because of the laws that have to be met and the type of information that's there. For the record, which made my family proud, I guess, I'm a Barron's 100 member, which means the top 100 financial advisors in the United States. I've been named to for the past decade and a little bit over that. And our group is one of the top 50 institutional consultants in the country. So we have the background to do this. And every member on our team, there's David Sears, as you can see, he's a CIMA. We have a CFP, CFA, I have master's degrees. We have multiple degrees also from the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. And Craig works out of New York, he's our fixed income specialist. If we had more time, I'd tell you what's going on in the fixed income market, because that's probably more interest to people. Collectively, we have 31 years of experience, each person on the team, and we have 19.6 years on average for each person in the group. And you can see, if you want to look through it, the titles and the certificates and things that we have in terms of what we have as a background. Can we go to the next slide? So let's go through the services that we provide. And the next one is a snapshot of what the current portfolio looks like. I should say, as consultants, the things that we've been retained to do for the city is, number one, we have a fiduciary contract with the City of Columbia. What that means is, if we do anything wrong, the errors and omissions insurance of UBS covers any errors. But more importantly, we have the deepest balance sheet of any group that does this in the world, that if something goes wrong, I assure you, UBS would write a check long before they want anything to go to the press. We've never, fortunately, in the 40 years I've been doing this, had that problem. But you want that kind of coverage for a plan that's worth in excess of $150 million. So we take fiduciary responsibility. For that, we help the committee and the city put together an investment policy statement and asset allocation studies every single year. We have multiple meetings. We come whenever is necessary, like this one. We're constantly on the phone probably every 2 weeks with somebody from the committee, so know what's going on. We've been on the phone with Matthew and a number of other people within the city with the past 6 weeks of what's going on with the coronavirus or COVID-19. We also do a spending policy. We do all the reporting. And more importantly, when I was with the city and I started in the business I'm in now, reporting is really important. Most consultants or people that do what I do for a living come in and report 30, 60, 90 days ago what happened. And that's not how I run my business. That's not how the city runs their business. So you have online capability through Matthew and the finance department to take a look at the returns through the previous day's close on the portfolio, okay? And we also save staff time because you have a corporate package of accounting that everything, the general ledger's on your system, so the accounting staff can upload everything right into your software and save the accounting time for the staff. So we view ourselves as off-balance sheet staff. So currently, we're sitting on about 41% large cap stocks. Small cap is about 23%, international is about 15.8%, and fixed income is about 29%. Now, what's different on here is when we started 10 years ago, the portfolio was 50% fixed income, 50% stocks. Your actuarial rate that is assumed that's supposed to be gotten on this portfolio is supposed to be in excess of 7%. It was closer to 8% when we started. As bonds came down or the yield came down, we had to take more risk on. We're at the lower limit where we're comfortable. Now we know that the U.S. Treasuries or the Fed fund rate is at zero, but we're still going to keep it at about 30% at this point. But at the last meeting, we started introducing real estate to the portfolio for the first time to get extra yield. So that's now in process, and we're looking at other ways that are less risky. So I'm going to show you that the diversification worked. What's different for the city and in our book of business that we manage money for is, number one, we have a lot more small and mid-cap stocks. We think that's important because in this environment before the COVID-19 and the oil crisis that just happened, small cap stocks, large cap companies couldn't grow organically. They had a hard time getting new customers in, so they tend to buy other companies, and the place they go for that is small and mid-cap stocks. And we've been right. That's been a big help to the portfolio and the return. The small cap manager last year did about 37% for the city. Okay. In terms of international, you talk to most people, they'll tell you that, or in our business, that you should be 20 to 30% or 35% in international stocks. We've argued against that for the past 10 years, because if you look at the composition of what's known as the S&P 500, almost 50% of the income from the companies in the S&P 500, which are U.S. companies, come from offshore. So we think we have plenty of exposure and no currency risk in the portfolio. Okay, so the headlines, did this work? And I'm going to say we've been tested the past 6 weeks. Last year, the return on the portfolio was about 22.67%. Through February, the first downturn, we're down 5.59% on a calendar year, and we're going to assume we're down to probably about another 9% through today, which is well below what's happening with the S&P. And actually, the bond market, we don't have enough time. The bond market is not making money for people now either, because it's what's called frozen, and I don't have time to go through that. What's more important for a fiscal year on your reporting status, through February, we're down 0.41. Okay, remember, on a calendar basis, we're down 5.95. We're down 0.41, and overall, we're down about 4.5% on a fiscal basis. So we think that the return did what it was supposed to, or the allocation has done what we wanted it to do. All right, and we're expecting more volatility. Let's go to the next slide. So I don't know if you want to go through this, but we control about $22 billion worth of assets, and we, through UBS, have the ability to negotiate on behalf of all our clients as if we had $22 billion going to portfolio managers, to index funds, things like that. So the fees that the city is paying is if you're a 20-some billion dollar portfolio. So if you look down the fee column in this, and it's by manager, the small cap managers like Kan Anderson, if you went directly in with $150 million and you carve 14% out, you'd probably be paying about 1%. We're at 42 basis points, or 0.42% of that one. So every dollar we can save is money that goes to the police and fire pension, okay, in the returns. Our fee is at 0.08%. That includes all trading and all the services I said. That is probably in the bottom quartile of expenses. It's probably more like 15 to 20 basis points, but we have the scale to bring those fees down. So fees are very low. And we currently, this is as of the end of the year, is $150 million. We're down about 11% from there, or 12% at this point. Below that, and I like to point this out to the City Council, because I'm not sure if everybody understands this, but every year you pretty much put money into the pension. That money never hits this pool of capital, if you're not aware of it, okay? In the past 11 years we've been dealing with the city, what happens is the money that the pensioners or the people working now put into the plan goes to pay the current pensioners. So it's a pass-through. And if you actually look, starting 5 years ago, we've withdrawn, or the city's withdrawn, about $5.3 million to offset the shortfall of paying out the pensions. So every year you put the money in, that money does not hit this pool of money. This is basically a closed pool of money. Since we've been dealing with the city, we probably had two inputs. And this year, we're probably going to withdraw about $2 million plus. So I want the city to understand that when you're looking at that. And that's what the negative is in the middle of the screen. And I guess the last highlight is we've been here slightly over 11 years. For the past 10 years, we've averaged about 7.79% in terms of return. So we've hit the actuarial assumption plus in a very difficult market. Questions or concerns? I think I went under 10 minutes. I'm not sure.
Questions at this point?
With the current volatility of the market, are you guys pretty comfortable with the way your assets are distributed?
Yes, we are. Yeah.
That would seem prudent. Thanks.
We have three things going on. We have a credit crisis. At the same time, we have OPEC playing games that they've played. Putin has miscalculated what Saudi Arabia was going to do. And the COVID-19 is really the wild card right now. I applaud the city for doing what you're doing, because I'm from the East Coast and I have my mask right here, okay? You guys are going to be doing the same thing probably.
Sorry to bring you all this way for...
No, that's fine. No.
Any other comments or questions?
I am happy that you came, because we've talked about this before and we have not heard. I mean, I think you've talked to our financial people, but
right.
As a council person, I'm happy to
And, you know, if the city council wants, we send out, what we do is not just talk at the meetings. We have a loop going out. So before we come into the meetings, we're sending out emails a couple times a week as to what our thinking is. And I have to throw one other thing in here. You have one of the best boards we're dealing with in terms of the professionals and the police and fire. They take the education really seriously, and Matt was on the board, and it becomes very vigorous discussions.
And so, you're here just so everybody knows. I mean, you come to those meetings quarterly, you or one
I come
of your partners.
To, the only meeting I didn't come to, just so you know, this is called a mission critical meeting. I had to get permission to come here. We had a pension meeting on Friday, and I was on for the first time on a speakerphone because we're not allowed to travel together at this point.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Okay. You know the
Thank
questions.
You. Thank you very much. Thank and if you. Anybody wants to be on the email loop, just give Matthew their email, and we'd be glad to send it to you.
Thank okay. you. Safe travels. We're moving on to a Cullimore Cottage update.
Randy Cole?
Mr. Cole?
Getting there.
All right, I'll be quick. So there's some council actions on the near horizon for allocating funds and approving agreements for the project. So I thought I'd do a quick update and answer any questions. So the main thing I wanted to focus on was project costs. That seems like the most important thing. There is a lot of complexity to the project because we're using a lot of different nonprofits, different financial tools going into the project. But where the city's funding going seemed like the most important update. So that's what I focused in on this. So this is the site layout. Members of council should have seen this over the last year and a half or so at various council meetings, but it's 10 homes over there on North 8th Street, 10 owner-occupied. The Housing Community Development Commission recommended doing 3 homes through the community housing development organizations like JobPoint, Habitat, and CMCA, and 7 through the Columbia Community Land Trust. This is a change from where we initially started. We were at 5 and 5, but we've been able to see that we can get quite a bit of savings through the community land trust, so they recommended a change. It involves a significant amount of stormwater upgrades, as well as some energy efficiency improvements. So these are some sketches of what 3 different home designs will look like over there. We do have mirrored images of each of the 3 homes. 2 of them are 3-bedroom, 2-bath. They're all under 1,500 square feet, so pretty compact in size. We do have a couple of 2-bedroom and 2-bath, right around 1,000 square feet going in. We've been able to sell some other 2-bedroom, 2-bath, and so we thought we'd try a few additional on this project. But you can see the appraised values vary between $135,000 to $145,000, depending on which design, but that's what they look like.
Hey, on the first rendering, where's that one-car garage? Is that on the side somewhere?
It is on the back. There was a lot of feedback from the neighborhood that they wanted rear-loading garages on North 8th Street, so a majority of the homes on that street are rear-loading.
And is there an alley back there? Or just
there is an alley that the homes, these other 2 designs, will face on the back that's been resurfaced. Those will have front-loading garages.
Nice. Thanks.
So we had a lot of input into the project from the neighborhood, the Columbia Community Land Trust Board, as well as the Chodos. So the designs got pulled a lot of different directions, but I think we incorporated as many values as we possibly could. But for me, costs were seemed very important from a lot of feedback I've received from council. So we took some steps to try and manage our costs, and we had some good results. So we aligned our Chodo and Columbia Community Land Trust bid process so that we could align our pricing and see where the most efficient use of dollars was going or would go. We procured an architect to really tighten down our designs and also increase the level of competition on our realtor procurement, our financing costs, and our builders. So we got a reduction in pricing in each of those items that was really good to see. Also, for the solar panels, there was a lot of interest in having solar panels on the homes. There was some varying feedback. Some folks thought that was more of a luxury item, but still important. So a step we committed to was looking at raising funds outside of CDBG and home dollars to help provide that kind of additional stability to the households. So we got commitments from Water and light board, that would still have to come through council, as well as some private donations from a local bank, and then a couple anonymous donor amounts. We're at about $85,000. We need about 100 to do 10 homes. So I would anticipate we'll get all the way there. So CHOTOs, or Community Housing Development Organizations, they're non-housing or nonprofit housing developers. They have a specific board criteria. JobPoint, Habitat, and CMCA meet that criteria. The intent of the CHOTO regulations from HUD is really to set aside 15% of our home funds to organizations that also provide an additional economic opportunity for low to moderate income populations. So a good example of that would be JobPoint and how they incorporate career training and skills for low-income minority youth. There are some challenges with the CHOTO regulations. You know, some of the CHOTO's capacity, they can only do so many homes per year. And then their overhead costs are a little bit higher. They have, most of the CHOTO organizations have a little more complex funding of their organizations, multiple federal funding sources, and then they have like an HR department or a finance department and a training department. So their costs are a little bit higher. So how do we partner with them? We set aside at least 15% of our home funds. And then at closing, the land gets donated to the land trust. So where they sell the homes, we protect all that affordability for future buyers. And then we look to use the Columbia Community Land Trust to provide additional capacity beyond the 15% cap. The important part of this slide is when we started out planning the process, we were going to do 5 and 5 on the homes. So we previously budgeted more funding in our CHOTO funds than what the Housing and Community Development Commission is recommending that the council will see at their first meeting in April. So we're required to do $185,000 out of our 2 years that we're putting towards this project. We were budgeted about $388,000. The HCDC landed on $236,000 because that's how it aligned with doing 3 homes. If we only did 2 homes, we wouldn't meet our cap. And they felt it was good to have the most efficient use of funds. And this next slide kind of shows the difference in pricing between the CHOTOs and the land trust. So pretty significant amount of savings, upwards of $20,000 to $30,000, depending on the home design. So we saw that as a good opportunity to pass all those savings on to the land trust buyer and create additional room to do more homes in the future. Some additional requirements we're going to put on the land trust is to finish out the buyer retention, do some additional parking spaces required along the alleyway, and some other landscaping and sidewalk work. If you look at just the lots alone on the 10 lots, if you figured in sanitary, sewer, stormwater, all the grading, all the additional infrastructure, and then land costs, about $37,000 a lot. But this is what council will see when we come to the first meeting in April on our budget amendment to allocate the funds to the project.
Any questions for Mr. Cole? I like how you've incorporated some of the lessons learned on your first round into some of these. Any other barriers that you see? And then maybe tell me what the construction time frame on these are.
Barry's, it's always a lot to manage on this large project, so it's just getting all the schedule to line up.
All at once?
What's that?
You doing them all at once?
We're going to do eight at once. So we're going to leave 2 open and make sure 2 sell before we start the next 2. We also had to leave some opening for supplies to reach into the back because the alleyway is not quite wide enough for a concrete truck and the supply truck. So they'll be right behind them, though.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Yep, thank you.
Let me ask Director Browning to come up and just by way of background, obviously this preparation didn't begin last week or even last month or even in January, and I think it's important to note that the City County Health Department for the last 50 years has been preparing for these types of events, whether that's the H1N1 or Ebola or the influenza epidemic. And while this specific virus is different, their response remains the same. I thought it was important that as we've all been having lots of conversations, I was on the phone last night with the governor, along with the mayors of Kansas City, St. Louis, Springfield, and Cape Girardeau. Been in regular contact with university leaders, including the president and chancellor and vice chancellor, Columbia College, Stevens College, and I'll get into some more of those discussions at our 7 o'clock meeting. I thought it was helpful for Director Browning to kind of come in and walk us through where we're at, the steps that were taken to date to prepare for this, as well as our city manager with respect to how we treat our own city employees and their thoughts there. And I think maybe we should take the next 15 to 20 minutes and just have a look at that. If there's any questions, I don't know if you want to get through all of your comments first, one of the key three things here that I want to emphasize is that I think we need to lead with epidemiology, that our decisions are backed by science and data, and I'm comfortable that they are. I think we need to speak with a unified voice, not just as a council, but as a community, with our three hospital providers, University of Missouri, Boone Hospital, Truman VA, with our institutions of higher education, with Columbia Public Schools, so that we can communicate credible information and that we communicate consistently. Because I think that enhances public confidence, both in our preparedness. I've made the comment before. I feel like this is a natural disaster unfolding in slow motion, and the three components to any disaster or catastrophic event are preparedness, response, and recovery. We have the opportunity now to take the next couple days, as you will hear has happened over the last few weeks, to prepare our community for that, and I think we will be well served. So, Director, thank you for all your work. I know you and your department have been working nonstop.
Thank you. So let me give you just a brief update. We monitor the CDC website, the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services, to keep an eye on what's happening. So as of noon today, the CDC website was updated, and there were 3,487 cases confirmed of COVID-19. To put that in some perspective, on Friday, when I left work, there were 1,629. So we more than doubled our cases over the weekend. There were 68 deaths in the United States, whereas as of Friday, there were 41. There were, I think, 47 jurisdictions represented. Now there are 53. So there's 49 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands all have had cases positive. Of those, the majority of those are still under investigation. 205, though, were travel-related, and 214 were close contacts to a case. In Missouri, as of today, there are 6 cases. We had a new one announced today. 3 are in Greene County, 2 are in St. Louis County, and 1 is in Henry County. Testing has been a topic that's a lot of interest to people. The Missouri State Public Health Lab has tested 170 people since they started. And again, 6 were positive, 164 were negative. In Boone County, as of today, 10 have been tested, approved for testing through the state health lab. Testing only recently became available through private laboratories, so that number is starting to build as their capacity increases, and we're going to start to see more capacity here in Boone County as well. And we especially learned that today when we had the hospitals at our meeting, that they think in the next week that private capacity will go up. So I was asked to talk about what actions we've taken to date. And I think you all remember I talked to her at the end of February when we had our meeting. We'd been watching this since it started to unfold. Well, we've implemented our department's incident command system, and we have daily meetings with our entire staff. We've increased our disease surveillance, including reassigning some of our current staff and other parts of the department, and actually bringing back some staff who have retired to help us out. We're coordinating with our partners to assist them with their preparedness. This includes healthcare, schools, businesses, and universities. I think I mentioned we've done a lot of tabletop exercises. People have asked us to come through and work with scenarios to help everybody be ready. Our medical director is attending the weekly infection control meeting with MU Healthcare. Literally, either daily, twice a week, or weekly, there is some sort of conference call. We have one with CDC. We have one with the MU system. We have one with the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services. And now we have nearly a daily call with the Metro Health Department health officers so that we can all find out what's going on in each other's community and speak with common, you know, common message and make sure that we're all doing what we need to do. We've received notifications of travelers that required monitoring from the Centers for Disease Control and the Department of Health and Senior Services. And so we've conducted the twice daily checks for fever and symptoms over the duration of the time that they self-isolate. We've monitored the University of Missouri Columbia students that returned from studying abroad in Italy and South Korea for their symptoms. We've increased our public communications via the city's website. And we've increased our communication with for city employees by working with the city manager to get more messages out to our city staff. We've advised our city facilities on disinfection and janitorial type issues so that people can stay safe. We have a dedicated group of employees that are fielding calls from providers in the public. The city, I will point out, is committed to not shutting off utilities for lack of payment during this time. Turning to some of the more social services type things that we also are concerned about, we met with the unsheltered homeless population through Room at the Inn and Turning Point, provided them with some hand sanitizer, thermometers, and some guidance on what to do if they get sick and how to get help. We provided a temporal thermometer to Turning Point to screen clients as they enter the facility. We also procured some hand washing, working on procuring some hand washing stations that they can have there. We put out a call to Medical Reserve Corps for volunteers to assist at Turning Point to replace some of their older volunteers because, you know, in this community, many of our volunteers tend to be in populations that might be at risk. We sent targeted guidance to community organizations like after-school programs and nonprofits on how to prevent COVID-19. We sent out guidance to the faith-based community. We sent out specific guidance to homeless providers and street outreach providers. We sent guidance on regarding the unsheltered homeless population and considering the RADI closure this weekend. We coordinated with providers and volunteer groups to assure that the population had tents and sleeping bags. Working with CPS regarding meal provision, should there be a closure, which we know there is going to be a closure at school. We're working with community-based providers on capacity for increasing capacity for home-delivered meals and groceries for vulnerable populations. We're working with Columbia Housing Authority on plans for opening Oak and Paquin Towers for help with providing food prep if needed and potential housing for isolation and quarantine. We provided a presentation and a Q&A session during the Sunday morning church service for St. Luke United Methodist Church, developed plans for a daily update for the public via our website. We've been in contact with all the long-term care facilities to determine how many of them are still allowing visitors. And obviously, we're working very closely with our local healthcare providers. So that's just sort of what we've been doing up till now. What's ahead? Next week, we're really going to be increasing our surveillance. I mean, it's been ramping up, but we're going to really do that. You know, if we find if there is a case, our work changes to contact tracing. So we switch from all this preparedness to going out and trying to identify all the contacts, make sure they get tested, quarantine, et cetera. So, well, like I said, we're going to bring on some additional temp staff and volunteers to increase our capacity in the department. And we're pulling in, like, we're pulling staff from other duties as needed to meet that need. I think you'll really see some changes in communications in this next week because community relations, and Steve is out there somewhere, you know, community relations is going to work a small JIC or a joint information center. So bring the city communicators in to make sure that we have daily briefings. We're going to really increase the social media. We're going to beef up the website. We're really going to coordinate those messages. There's a daily call that will be happening now with all the county partners that the Office of Emergency Management is putting together so that everybody will know what everybody is doing, and it'll be much more seamless. We won't have to all find it out for ourselves. Contact center is going to be provided some scripting. We're going to work on river control because that's there. So, in a nutshell, that's where we're at right now. I'm happy to take any questions. John, do you want to add some of the things you've been thinking about with the city?
John, from an employee perspective, do you want to walk through any of those?
Yeah, one thing we heard in our meeting today at 1:30 from all the partners is compassion, you know, and I think that's the right word. We have to have compassion with the schools, public school closing. We're going to have a lot of parents that don't have daycare or don't have, you know, don't have this, the time to take off. So we're going to have to figure out how we pay them. You know, I heard Peter talk about, you know, they're paying all their staff, whether they're there or not. And so we have to figure that out. And so we have to look at that as well. And you know, the economy is going to be down. I can just tell you that. And so we're already trying to figure out how we're going to budget for all this, how we're going to adjust what we're doing this year, and how we maintain a level of service that our people are accustomed to. We have to pick up the trash. You know, that doesn't mean they all have to be trash truck drivers to pick that up. We've done other things before to help with picking up trash, and so we will continue to do that. And so we're going to, people that aren't busy or people that things that we're not doing are going to be reassigned to do other things, and we're going to try to keep everybody busy and everybody working as diligently as we can and as safe as we can. And so that's where we're at. As Stephanie says, we've stopped disconnections for non-payment. We're encouraging, you know, social distancing, I guess, is the term of the day. We're enhancing cleaning overnight. We've changed our cleaners to kill germs much more quickly. We're using a lot of hand sanitizer. I know CVB's monitoring and monetizing cancellation of events. You know, we're losing a lot of things. I heard that Broadway is 10% occupied right now, so that's, you know, unheard of for them. So that's going to be difficult. So I'd be happy to answer any questions council may have.
Before I begin, let me just tell you, I think the three biggest challenges we face are testing. The state health lab will sometime this week have the capacity to do 1,000 tests per week. A private lab can do about 800 to 1,000 per day. We're getting additional labs and testing machines certificated in Columbia soon. The comment that I would make, and we'll get to some of this at 7 o'clock as well, on my phone call last night with the governor and the state health director, they have a goal to test every Missourian with a fever of 104 and a dry cough. They're not on track to meet that once the virus hits, which is why I think the extreme proactive measures we will contemplate at the next meeting are helpful to reduce that demand for the test. The other item and that we talked about was really just, as John indicated, the impact on families. I think this virus is really going to expose and exploit all of the inequities in our system with respect to our healthcare system, those that have health insurance and those that do not, those that have childcare, paid leave, average hourly workers are not going to have the same options that other families do. Those that have access to technology and those that don't. When you talk about going online, that only works if you have internet at home. So I think all of these issues we're going to continue to grasp and grapple with. I also think the community impact with respect to the census, the April 7th elections, and other areas are something that we're going to continue to discuss on a daily, if not hourly, basis. Let me open it up to questions for both Director Browning or the city manager.
I have a question for Browning. For individuals who test positive but cannot afford the cost of the test, are there any provisions to cover those costs?
Well, yes and no. At the state public health lab, the cost of the test is free. The challenge with the state public health lab is that You have to meet their screening criteria to be tested. What doesn't change is that you still have to have a well, we were able to get somebody in recommended for testing through our department, but the test still requires a visit to a doctor. So what we've been doing is, you know, referring people to their providers. We do have Family Health Center here who takes new patients who could be that, you know, we have, well, I don't know, actually, the MU students that have been here, I'm assuming that they're still here. But if somebody has an issue, we could, they could call our department, and we would, like, try to see what resources we could help with them.
The average cost is what?
It costs, through a private lab, it's $199 if you're insured. And, well, this is what have been quoted, and if you're private pay, it's $99. So, but then the visit, and like right now, if you have to go, they've changed the recommendations. It used to be that you had to be in a negative pressure room. They have changed that recommendation, but if you had, that would be a room at the emergency department, and so as you can imagine, the cost of an ER visit on top of that would be substantial. So, I know that MU Healthcare told us is doing virtual visits for $10. Our city insurance through United Healthcare is doing something similar. So for those with insurance, that's a low-cost way to go without putting yourself out there in the community and without potentially, if you think you are sick, exposing others in that environment.
Mr. Scala.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion in the news about the difference between containment and mitigation. We have no confirmed cases here in this community.
Correct.
One of the largest communities that do not. But we are proceeding with that assumption, aren't we, in terms of
right.
mitigation? We're
because
assuming
of the fact that we haven't
We haven't tested some folks, so we really don't can't be sure.
Correct.
So
correct.
It's a mitigation policy that we're pursuing.
Yes. I mean, I would assume that we would be seeing more cases if there was more testing, and so we would be mitigating.
Other questions? Mr. Pitzer.
So as testing becomes more available, is there a possibility that the city would be able to offer testing?
Not really. I mean, we have, Scott, what do we have, 7 nurses? All right. And they're going to be doing contract tracing. And we haven't even done influenza testing in probably 10, 15 years. You know, we refer that out.
So the majority of testing will be done through private providers?
The private sector. Now, there's some, you know, I think as the test becomes more available, we may be able to work with our partners to ramp that up and do something very low cost, if no cost. But the testing capacity's got to greatly increase.
And does the city have any role in, like, some of these drive-through test centers that are being set up and things like that?
We're actually meeting tomorrow on that. Mm-hmm. So Springfield just experimented with that today. And they had a 4-hour drive-through with the medical order, though. You still had to have a doctor's order. And they tested about 40.
Okay. And I'm glad to hear that you're be ramping up the communications, too. I've just have noticed over the last several days, you know, a lot more questions coming in.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's just a lot of confusing guidance that's out there.
Right. Well, and it's changing.
And it's changing.
By the day.
Right. And it may change this evening also. So being able to communicate that on a clear, consistent, regular basis, right. I think will
it's
be
important.
More and more important every single day. Thank you.
Dr. Peters, anything?
I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
How deep do you go in terms of contact consulting?
Well, it's just a very thorough interview, so I think it's going to be, obviously it's going to be different for every person, but like, you know, you would find out like where they worked, where they spent their time, their family contacts. So you would go out quite a bit, and you would be assessing the risk and like the likelihood of exposure for those contacts. And go from there. So it would be like, I can't say there's a hard and fast for every person because it's going to differ based on their interactions.
Now, just for clarification's sake, I want to go back to my first question.
Uh-huh.
So that it is possible that someone may, in fact, manifest the symptoms and still not be able to afford the testing.
Correct, at this time. If they have if they're not Medicaid, yes, correct. It's terrible.
Okay.
Bethany, what are the What are the symptoms that someone has to display to be tested?
Considered? So you want the state health department's guidelines, or I think how the hospitals or the providers are doing it is they are, they're trying to rule out, like, if they've had other illnesses, like make sure they don't have influenza, right? And they're doing some different panels like that. So for the state health department, it's a fever or signs or symptoms of lower respiratory illness. So that would be cough or shortness of breath. And any person, including a healthcare worker, who had close contact with a laboratory-confirmed patient within the previous 14 days. So that's one. Fever and, again, the cough or shortness of breath requiring hospitalization and travel from a geographic area, which, you know, are all the... It's pretty much all of Europe, Japan, South Korea, China, Iran, Washington State, New York, Westchester County, New York, and Santa Clara, California. Third one is fever with severe acute lower respiratory illness with no alternative diagnostic or diagnosis. And no exposure has been identified. So you can see it's like a pretty thorough little thing. It's pretty hard to get in screened at the state right now. And part of that is just because they don't have enough tests, so they've had to ratchet that down. But if you were going to your provider, it would probably be, you know, fever, illness, mm-hmm. maybe some contact, travel.
You know. Usually a fever's like over 100.4
usually.
So, oh, you're saying 100.4?
Yeah, I think that's what, it's about 100.4. 100,
oh, that's good.
About 100, yeah.
I thought you were saying 104.
No, 104.
And I was like, wow, that sounds
yeah, that's
pretty
so
darn
high.
High. Okay, yeah. Thank you. I feel better now, sort of.
Any other questions? Mr. Thomas.
Switching more to the economic impacts on people that are going to lose work and lose income, are we coordinating in any way with United Way or social service providers to create protections for those people in terms of staying in their homes, having access to food and so on? And I've had a couple of inquiries today of people wanting to know, they want to donate some money to support those causes. Is there a centralized place for that to be done?
I think John Baker is going to be here later to talk about the Community Foundation, and they're setting something up on that end of it. As far as with United Way, I think staff has reached out to them.
I haven't read the emails today, but I know there's some emails going back and forth, you know. And there are a number of providers. I think that if they can coordinate and do something that's unified, but like a really, the one thing I think that's really important is that we use our incident command structure, and we know, like, if we're doing social services, connecting with agencies, we're hearing what they need, to be able to have somebody to turn to and say, hey, this is what the agencies need, would be great, like, to have a funnel instead of coming from everywhere, you know.
I also asked the governor last night to consider reducing the restrictions on accessing the unemployment compensation fund for laid off workers who, through no fault of their own, are unable to go to work because of this. This also affects tipped workers disproportionately because they are already sub minimum wage and therefore pay in less to that fund with the employer's match. So I think anything that we can do to help them, you know, groceries and all of those, it's not a lot of money. It's like $230 a week in unemployment compensation for the average worker, I think is going to be helpful. I asked the Columbia Chamber to join me in adding their voice to that effort as well, with their counterparts, with employers and decision makers in Jeff City on that. And a good suggestion was made this afternoon. As we have displaced workers who are unable to go to work, there are other industries that may need additional workers, like grocery stores, and a way to match those two together temporarily. And, you know, whether that is the our Workforce Development Office, Workforce Investment Funds here, may be a good, effort over the next 2 to 4 to 6 to 8 weeks. Anything further? Seeing none, why don't we close this work session and reconvene in 7 minutes to start the regular council meeting.